In the digital reality, evolution over revolution prevails. The QA approaches and techniques that worked yesterday will fail you tomorrow. So free your mind. The automation cyborg has been sent back in time. TED speaker Jonathan Wright's mission is to help you save the future from bad software.
This podcast is brought to you by Eggplant. Eggplant help businesses to test, monitor, and analyze their end-to-end customer experience and continuously improve their business outcomes. Hey, and welcome to the show. Today I have a very special guest, also a recent article writer for theqalead.com. You have to check out his quality engineering tips for remote teams. So, Bernard, how's it going today, and how's the lockdown in London?
Hi. So, yeah, everything's okay. Seems like it's starting to get a little bit lifted. Of course, for me, because I was already working remotely, it wasn't as much of a change as I imagine to some people.
Yeah, I noticed that you refer to, from your company you're working at the moment, Auth0. You know, you've got this great article about kind of 7 years of tips. And I guess you're in the lucky position where you've been used to remote working.
Yeah, I think I chose my time right, because I joined Auth0 about 6 months ago. I've worked remotely before, but this is the first time that I worked for a company that was fully remote or globally distributed, where, you know, we have, I think it's in engineering, it's like 90% is remote. So that kind of culture of remote first really plays a big role in how your day-to-day goes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I noticed, you know, with this week that we're in, it's my 69th day, in lockdown, but, you know, companies like Twitter and some of the big names in, Silicon Valley have said that actually they don't mind staff working remotely indefinitely. So they, you know, the idea is that maybe this is the new norm. So I know you've got a great article with some tips around remote working. For those, the listeners that have not, read it yet, could you give them kind of a highlight of what you covered in the blog?
Yeah, I think if you don't mind, I'll start with what I think is probably, like, beyond all the very specific tips I gave to this kind of role. I think one of the things that you have to get used to from the beginning is the concept of asynchronous communication. You have to go away from that mindset that you might have in the office, or where you can just, you know, call someone or look aside to your desk mate and ask a quick question. And you have to realize that people are working potentially in different time zones, but certainly with very different schedules, especially, since a lot of people are working at home with kids in right now. So, you know, you have to get used to the fact that you won't directly get back the response you might need. So I think that's like a bit of a shift that you have to do in your mindset. And I think it's one of the last tips I give in the article, but probably one of the most useful ones is you should kind of learn how to make use of that time where you might be blocked or waiting for someone. Because if you don't use it efficiently, you might end up feeling like you're actually being less productive, and it's the remote situation's fault, when really it's more about getting the right routine, tools, and mindset in.
Yeah, it's something I've always kind of personally struggled with. You know, I've worked for a lot of investment banks, and they kind of cover the globe, and you kind of have this handoff between, you know, Singapore or New York, and, you know, the time zone, 8 hours, it kind of splits, and you've got, you know, you sometimes have that challenge where, you know, you're waiting for some other team in Moscow or somewhere else to come online before, you know, an action can then get resolved, which, like you said, is a blocker. You know, does this really change how software engineering is done? Because, you know, there was this kind of, you know, you're taking a task, if you're doing Kanban or something along the board, and, you know, maybe you've got to have other activities you can work on in parallel.
Yeah, I think so. You know, the maturity of where your software engineering is at is really telling, in my opinion, of how well you're going to adapt to remote working. Because if the culture around your company still has a lot of like micromanagement and a lot of deliverables that get shipped between teams, as opposed to a team kind of owning the process, then you might struggle a bit. The other example is just where I think the culture is important is your team might not have both the right tools as well as the right mindset in place already for that remote first culture. And an example of that is, like I mentioned, I used to work in another company, I think like almost 3 years back now. I was actually working from Portugal at the time, and they were here London based, but I was one of the few people in the company to do that and the only one in my team to be remote. And the difference I see in how our calls go now, where everyone is remote and, you know, the company as a whole has to solve that problem, versus back then where, you know, only I was in that situation. It changes things a lot with, you know, things as small as the audio quality or the video quality or the kind of collaborative tools that you're using, which might not be as well adapted if you don't have that remote first mindset. So I think where companies now need to take a step back is first invest in those remote first approaches, but also it might require a little bit of redesigning on how you ship software, how you move those deliverables across different teams, or how even the teams are structured in some cases, I think.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. I was on a really interesting call with some of the MIT guys, and we're talking about gamification. And, you know, it was interesting because, you know, halfway through, one of the speakers who were involved in the call was kept on breaking up. The quality was really difficult to talk. They were only in Italy, but they were still having real problems with bandwidth. And actually, it became a discrimination in a kind of a poor quality connection discrimination.
Definitely.
Because they kind of said, well, actually, we're going to have to carry on without them in the discussion. And, you know, that's quite hard for some people. And I guess, you know, I was watching a great keynote from Gartner yesterday, who they were kind of saying what the new norms are. And they were kind of saying, you know, the security and home office, you know, you've got to deal with things like, and I know you've got the kind of the performance experience, so we'll get onto that. But, you know, kind of things like people sharing the bandwidth at your home. So people watching Disney Plus and, you know, it starts eating into that connectivity stuff. So, you know, that's a real different challenge with, you know, people who've got families and maybe their home infrastructure is just not up to the job.
Yeah. And I think that, like, going back to your point about it being a little discriminatory, I remember in my previous company, not the one I was working remotely, but just one where I was here in London. We had another team. It wasn't mine, who had, a lot of people who were remote in that particular team. And I really liked their approach because they used to organize, they were a platform or SRE team. So they used to organize this monthly meeting where they told some news and got some feedback from the backend engineering community as a whole, which I was part of. And that meeting used to be in person, but because they started getting so many people who were remote and they started to feel that it was discriminatory, they actually moved, even though a lot of them were in the office, they actually moved that meeting to being fully remote so that everyone could be on the same experience level. I think that's an example of like a team, or in this case, even a company, adapting to that and kind of avoiding some of those pitfalls.
I think, you know, these challenges have come for quite a few years now. You know, I remember working for a company, a commodity platform, who were they insisted in having virtual conferences all the time. So you'd have it just running on one of your screens. So even if you VPN'd in, one of your monitors would have all the rest of your teammates. And, you know, they used to have a lot of fun with it. You know, people used to put funny comments on people's, you know, screens, but it was this kind of, you know, even though you were literally next to each other in the office, it was this always on, you could dip in and out and pull the right people in. But again, that requires the kind of the right equipment. And also it's that kind of mentality as well. And, you know, I think there's a lot of companies that are struggling around with, you know, trying to understand policies and what works well for their staff. And, you know, but there's some of us who are so used to remote working, and like yourself, who's got all these experiences, because these are the pitfalls that, you know, people quite easily will just kind of go, oh, well, you know, I have no idea how to work with a team in Lisbon when we're in the UK. And I work for a large pizza company who all their resources were in Lisbon, because there's a massive .NET community out there.
That's true.
And, you know, it's you know, a perfect center of excellence. And they used to, you know, bring in a special equipment to have, you know, screens with the team connected all the time. And, you know, it works so well. But obviously, they had to get it working right. And that took a bit of time. And most people don't have that learning curve to kind of get those lessons learned.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's a little bit of Darwinism now, right? You have to adapt to live on. This is kind of the new reality, at least for the time being. And Mike presumably even change how we do a lot of this in the future, even if things return back to normal.
And it's interesting, because I remember going around some great engineering companies, and one of my favorite things I ever saw was a little traffic light system next to people's monitor, and they could set the traffic light to say, you know, red, I'm busy, don't disturb me, you know, green, I'm okay. And it was a great idea, wasn't it? But, you know, part of it is now you're on your Slack, you're on your Teams, you know, yes, you may have set, you know, a status away or something like that, but you know, since MSN Messenger went, you know, we don't really have this opportunity to kind of say, you know, prioritize, like Office Communicator used to have this kind of thing where it'd say, you know, if an important priority message came through, interrupt me, but otherwise, you know, automatically send a response saying, look, I'm in the middle of a meeting, you know, can I get back to you? Here's my current schedule, you know, it'll be finished in 40 minutes, you know. Do you see that kind of coming through, that maybe there's a virtual version of yourself that is batting off the standard questions that you can answer in your sleep, and then, you know, it connects you when it really needs you?
Yeah, I think you touched upon an important point, a couple of them actually. So one is, before I mentioned how you have to change your mindset. But that's both true as the person asking for information, as well as the person that is potentially delivering that information. So, for example, as myself, I work in a team that actually integrates with a lot of different teams, or kind of like quality advocates. We build infrastructure for a lot of teams. So I might need to interface with a lot of these teams. Because the company has that remote mindset, we all have the mutual understanding that both me as a person that might be asking something from one of those teams, and them asking us something, there has to be that concept of a synchronous communication. You know, people understand if you don't respond directly. And I think that brings me to my second point that I think is important. You mentioned personal calendar. I think it's one of the things about remote working is you have to be a little bit more verbose and transparent about what you're doing. It doesn't mean that you need to have like your schedule fully online, but those blocks of time that you really are busy with the team, they should be publicly accessible to other people too, so they can easily see whether they can contact you or not. And also, you know, there's formal systems, at least in our company, of asking if you have a formal request for a specific team. We've got engineering service desk tickets, for example. If it's something that takes them more than a little bit, it's something that they can take their own time to go and pick it up. I've never dealt with anyone in our company who I felt wasn't as soon as they could help that they didn't want to, so that they were, you know, purposely avoiding. And similarly, I've never come to the situation where I'm ignoring someone, but I have had to delegate my time, like, and say, okay, I'm not going to answer this right now, because it's going to take me a little bit of time, and I would prefer to give them a better answer when I have full time for it, as opposed to like a half-assed answer.
I think you're raising a really interesting problem here, which I don't think anyone's really addressed, is that there's a kind of a lead time to the correct answer and the doing the right, giving them the right information. And there's this, I guess, knee-jerk reaction to respond back because people have been waiting. And I noticed a lot of the solution integrators for many years now have had this kind of email at the bottom of their email. They'd say something like, you know, we encourage flexible working. So, you know, we may send you emails out of normal out working hours. We do not expect you or put any pressure that you'll respond. And I think, you know, that's the kind of thing, because I get it all the time. You know, I guess it's this anxiety of, you know, someone pings you on Slack, you know, you have to feel like you have to give them what they need. Otherwise, you know, they're blocked. And, you know, and I guess that's the thing. If you've got to have that pushback to say, look, I don't have the answers for you right now, but, you know, I'm going to go off, I'm going to investigate, and I'm going to keep you kind of up to date with, you know, how long I estimate it's going to take me to work on that. And, you know, that was one of the problems we were always bad at engineering, was estimation, right? How long is it going to take to do that? You know, do you find that, you know, that's a problem when you're, like you said, you're working between lots of different, you know, third parties? You know, how do you do those handshakes work? Is it down to an account management or is program management or even, you know, product management? What's the key behind it?
So to clarify, even though we do integrate with third parties, like in my particular role, they are third parties, but within the company. So they're third parties in the sense that they're outside teams of from myself. I'm not directly in their software development lifecycle, but we are like one big team rowing in the same direction. So from that sense, there is that mutual understanding. To answer your question more specifically, I think one of the things that helps, like I mentioned, is the service desk, like the ability to formally say, I need the help of this team. And the team part is really important there, because you were mentioning before, okay, like someone messages you and you might feel like you're blocking them if you don't respond quickly. But maybe that person could have messaged the entire team. And if you are, as a company, fighting for not segregating information, this is why I said it's really important to actually be a little bit more verbose and have a lot of information online, and also to not have just too many subject matter experts. You need them, but you don't want them to control all the knowledge. You want to share that knowledge so that one single person isn't the cause of blocking someone. Between that, the service desk tickets or equivalent, as well as, you know, maybe some formal arrangements that we're starting to build with some of the teams that we're going to be interfacing more with, where you have some responsible people within our team as well as within each of their teams to touch point. Between those things, I think it's quite manageable. But I'm not going to lie, it's a challenge, especially if you're not coming from a situation where you've had to deal with these problems. But it's a solvable, in my opinion, solvable thing.
Absolutely. And I guess it looks at new metrics and measurements as well. So, you know, people talk about cycle time and mean time to recovery. You know, maybe it is this mean time to resolution, but, you know, you're tracking the potential, you know, where you've got some, like you said, a service desk, you've maybe got some kind of first line chat ops kind of capability to kind of understand how to categorize it. Then you're using RPA to your best of your ability for, you know, some standard kind of service management kind of capabilities. And then it goes into some kind of team pool where people can actually, you know, all jump in and track this all the way through to its resolution. You know, maybe those metrics will be important in the future.
Yeah. And, you know, just make, you know, especially if you have a process like a service desk, make sure it's a first-class citizen within your project. We as a team also have our own service desk. And one of the things that we've done recently is make sure that as part of our daily stand-up, the first thing we do is actually look at the engineering service desk board, which we've kind of integrated within our project. And make sure that there's nothing new that we might have missed, as well as talk about anything there that, and who's going to pick it up or is it done yet kind of thing. It's a first class citizen at the moment in our team. And I know in other teams as well.
And, you know, I find that really interesting. It's, you know, one of my pet peeves with has always been first and second line support. You know, how does, you know, it get that kind of prioritization within the organization? And, you know, they see the value of just the importance of the relationship of their customers and how quickly they can do that, but also the prioritization. So even if they're using something like ServiceNow, it's how that feeds back into the SDLC, the resourcing capability you've got, which is obviously finite from a development and engineering perspective. And, you know, I remember a recent role that I was with, they used to have every day, they used to have someone they used to class as Batman, and Batman was responsible for saving the day. And, you know, it was a great idea. But at the same time, you know, it kind of felt like it was the disconnect of what kind of DevOps was all about. You know, the idea that there was, you know, it wasn't just, you know, throw it over the fence and then it's operations problem now. And it was more now you're delegating someone to take on the first line, second line support on a rota basis. And, you know, they have to solve the problems and the tickets. And, you know, maybe that's still not really what we envisioned when we started talking about kind of DevOps to kind of NoOps kind of approach.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And I mean, part of it is a cultural change to make sure that it's really integrated in our software delivery development lifecycle. One of the things that I actually tried in our team was, so we had service desk, but you kind of had to go to a different place in Jira for it, a different board and project. So, you know, using the Jira filters and such, I made sure that we also had a board that pulled in from that filter within our project. So really, you know, it's very visible. And like I said, it's the first thing we do in standup that it must be something that we tackle. And it's definitely not something that a specific person will tackle. We will tackle as a team. Of course, there might be some people that are more catered to solving a certain problem because maybe they have a little bit more information about that, or they were the cause of it, or they are were already working with those people. But we, you know, we work as a team, and like you said, I think that's kind of one of the things with DevOps. You don't want to be throwing things over the fence.
Absolutely. And I want to dig a bit deeper because I know you're incredibly technical. And, you know, it'd be great to kind of get an idea of, you know, some of the challenges you're doing, you know, some of the kind of testing you've been involved with and, you know, just generally, you know, how you've, you know, how you do quality engineering.
Sure. So, obviously, that's a very broad topic. I'll try and actually answer that from the perspective of both my recent companies. So my current one, Auth0, and my previous one, Dazone. They are kind of different. They're similar in the sense that they're both exceptionally well doing startups that are, you know, doing extremely well in their market and have had a very fast growth. And they're basically like here to stay. But their engineering culture was slightly different, and even some of the maturity of some of the engineering practices are a bit different. Out of, you know, some of the pain points of growth of the companies and sometimes the field that it is, and I find that distinction is important because when you go into a new company. And you come with a tool belt of things that you've done before and potentially things that you'll learn there. When you go and you try to apply that, I think you have to be careful not to try and apply everything you know, because it won't necessarily fit the maturity or the stage or the even just the tech that company is using. And the reason I'm saying this is, for example, one of the things I've been very involved with at Dazone doesn't quite fit Auth0, which is contract testing.
And you mentioned contact testing. What is contact testing?
So contract testing. So so when you have an application or a set of applications, generally you will have maybe a front end and maybe a back end, and the most crude or even more most used example of what a contract is in this situation is the integration between that front end and that back end, which basically means, you know, the front end is expecting the back end to return some shape of data that then the front end needs to be able to deal with. So this is in its most simple form, what is a contract. Now, as engineering has changed over time, and we now have things like microservices architectures for the backend, we've had some interesting challenges when it comes to testing, because whilst before you might have had a single backend monolith, now you might have that monolith, which is like a huge piece of code with a lot of logic, might have been broken down into separate services. So instead of a single service or a couple of services, you suddenly might have dozens or hundreds of services. And you want to test the integration between those services. So if service A talks to service B, for example, if service A is a user service that talks to a billing service, the user service needs to understand the shape of the data that comes from the billing service. So if it comes with a field that says currency that the user might be using in their account, it's important that you test that integration between that. Now, the challenge there when you're dealing with dozens or hundreds of these services is that in order to test all these integrations, the problem, you know, doesn't really grow linearly. And also, suddenly you might have to, whilst instead of spinning up just one single service, one monolith, you might have to be spinning up a lot of services, which you can kind of orchestrate with Docker, for example, but it's still a hard problem to solve. That's one part of it. It's just how hard it is to do this. And the other part of the problem is that when you are testing the integration between two services, you're making some assumptions. You're making some assumptions about how the other service is going to respond. So as I'm testing the integration on service A, I'm kind of assuming that the shape of the data on the billing service, for example, is still the one I thought it was at the time. But in this microservices architecture, the whole point is that these services can move and evolve very fast. So over time, it's not guaranteed that your contract, that integration that you're trying to test, is still valid. Contract testing aims to solve these problems. When it kind of does it in like almost a synchronous integration testing where you don't need to spin up your whole environment. You're going to make some assumptions still, but you're going to verify those assumptions over time, with exactly the services that you're consuming. So I know it's a long, answer, but it's a complicated topic.
No, I guess it either gets more complex when you talk about things like nano services and the next, you know, the serverless kind of approach to these kind of technologies. Yeah. You know, I think there's always a generation of, and I love what you had to say about using those blueprints and patterns that you've used at other places and how you've got to make sure that you know, sometimes the technology doesn't always align or the maturity always aligns. You know, when it comes to kind of the stuff that you're doing, you know, how do you choose the kind of the right approach to going to something like, I don't know, performance or security or something that you're helping with a customer?
So if you don't mind, I'll continue with the current example. So when I got to Auth0, whilst the zone was very much already all at the place that they had all these microservices, and even there, it was complicated to introduce contract testing, and it took time. When I got to Auth0, their model, their architecture model was very different. They are working towards, having some separation of concerns with services, but some of it is still, not split into microservices. So perhaps contract testing didn't really fit that. And it's important that, I think it was important for me to get there. And it's like, I think I had just been accepted to give a workshop when I joined Auth0 to give a workshop on contract testing. So obviously, you know, contract testing was on my mind. It's the last thing I was doing heavily on the zone. You know, I was submitting talks for it, etc. So it is the thing I was doing at the time. It was important for me to get into that new company and stop a little bit my excitement for it when it applied to work. As much as I would want to work to a place where we have that, I think there are other more fundamental things that we have to tackle before we get to a point where it's even stable to run contract testing. Because the problem of trying to retrofit these cool technologies onto any architecture is that you might end up just creating something that's not very stable. And what I find in testing, especially in the kind of team that I am, where I'm providing like tooling and infrastructure and advice to several teams on testing, you have to be really careful to make sure that you're providing value so that the other teams don't kind of get discouraged for testing. Because in our current company, developers are responsible for testing in their teams. And we are kind of like a quality advocacy team that builds tooling, infrastructure, and gives advice. So it's important for us that they are still keen to work with us. And part of that is, you know, not having flaky things in the pipeline. And a lot of that comes down to that choice in the beginning. You have an idea, sure, but think it through. Does it really apply here? And does it solve the real pain points of the company? And I think that's where load testing will come in if we talk about it at Auth0. One of the pain points at the moment that I joined Auth0 was more around performance testing. It was a much bigger thing to tackle and much more important thing than something like contract testing.
You can definitely say that again. I've been doing the every Wednesday we're doing the Performance Advisory Council meetups and with people like Mark Tomlinson and Scott Moore and Wilson Marr. And you know, I'm always fascinated by performance engineering and you know just how complex those ecosystems are. And I guess with, you know, this, like you said, being quite a lean startup, you know, engineering to that kind of scale and then things like SRE and all those other things coming through, you know, how did you approach doing the load testing for Auth0?
Yeah. So with Auth0's use case, they were quite big already. Like they grew quite organically. So by the time I joined, we're talking already about, probably half a thousand engineers, maybe a bit more. So it's already quite a sizable company. And like I said, we've got several different product teams. There was already some work that was being done by our colleagues, some very good work at Auth0 before I joined on changing the frameworks. And I think that was a very important decision point. At the time, they were using JMeter and you know, JMeter is not bad. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's kind of like a little bit behind its time. And it was the developer experience for writing those performance tests was not the greatest for developers. And again, in a company like ours, where we want developers to feel like they are responsible for quality too, I feel like the developer experience and the stability of what you're providing as tooling is really important. They had already made the switch to Artillery. Now, it just so happens that I had worked at The Zone with the creator of Artillery. So it's kind of like a good match there. And, you know, I had some thoughts about it, about how to use the tool to the maximum of its capacity. And I think a tool like Artillery was perfect in this kind of ecosystem because it's written, you write the tests both in YAML and the logic in JavaScript. So I recommend that one and K6, for example. Are both really good in this JavaScript ecosystem. And keeping the tooling kind of close to the ecosystem of the development is, I think, also a really good bonus point for developer experience because then, you know, your developers are going to write tests in the language they are comfortable with already and they're using every day. In terms of like how to tackle for the whole company, one of the approach that we took I think the team in general did a very good job in focusing on that was to be very data driven. As Auth0, we provide identity as a service and we have a lot of customers that use our tool to integrate in their products. So we are a software as a service company. As a result, we have a lot of data from different usage patterns of our product. And we wanted to basically analyze that data. and try to understand and categorize how our different customers behaved, and try to group that a little bit into how they use the environment, because some people used it very lightweight, in a very lightweight mode, while others sometimes hammered the environment, as well as the kind of like the size of the data that they had in the environment was also an important consideration. And then taking that as a learning to drive which endpoints we want to hit, which ones maybe, like, if we notice that our databases was a problem, were a problem, one of the challenges, maybe we would exercise endpoints that we know hit certain collections in those databases more, because maybe those collections have created incidents in the past. You know, things like this that are very data-driven, I think, are kind of key to performance engineering in general.
Yeah, no, I think an Artillery, you know, is a great product for that, especially if you're on, you know, the AWS stack. You know, it logically makes sense. And, you know, they use a kind of a serverless kind of architecture as well. You know, it's, I guess, you know, like you said, you're picking the right tool, whether or not, you know, you're using, you know, you're terraforming or you're using CloudFormage or something else. You know, part of it is you've got to choose the right tool that's going to do the right things for you, and also for you to support the developers with their challenges, which they have. One of the interesting things I always find, is around things like time series data. And, you know, have you come across things like the tick stack and InfluxDB, or how did you collate those metrics that you got from, like you said, one customer that's lightly using the environment and another which is, you know, hammering it, and you've got different volumetrics profiles that you're going to have to do. And obviously that influences your AWS, its, you know, configuration and infrastructure.
We heavily use Datadog for more like live performance and metrics of what's going on. Our observability teams are investing a lot in giving us more tooling to dig deeper into some of the problems and try to trace back. I think two key things to answer your question was that we keep a lot of the data, obviously not sensitive information, but about the usage patterns of the people using our product. And because we store that data with an internal solution, we are able to, you know, query back that data in the ways that matter to us. So we were able to profile based on the endpoints that were most used, the size of the tenants, as we call them, the people using our environment, the customers, the sizes of that, meaning, you know, how much data they were using, as well as, you know, how those endpoints affect collection. So that's one side of the thing. The other side is incident analysis. Incidents, if we're doing that right and we're keeping track of the data that we get from the incidents as a general rule, they over time give us a good idea of what are the parts of the product that might be performing or badly more often. And we had a couple of incidents that were from related sources. And that was, for example, our last quarter, as a team, one of our goals was to focus on building some load tests for those kind of endpoints that we saw were more heavily used and maybe had been behind some of the incidents that we had. So I think it just goes back to making sure that as a company, you are keeping that data. So adding that observability in is very important. And then that you're making use of that data, because if it's just there and you're not using the data to make decisions, informed decisions, then you're just wasting money on keeping the data, probably.
Absolutely. It's quite interesting you were saying about Datadog. You know, I've been using a tool called Orange Data, which was such a strange name for a data visualization tool. But there's so many of those tools coming through now that help provide, you know, visualization of what's actually happening. And I think that's really important, that people can understand the data. And, you know, one of the common mistakes I used to make was around, you know, people looking at like average response times and kind of hid the real data. Yeah. And, you know, I think Tableau and those kind of tools that can actually visualize all the data and give you, you can look at it from different viewpoints, really helps to kind of give you an overall view of the system health and, you know, how to get better at what you're doing. And I guess that is also that quick feedback that you give to your, to the developers. If they're owning quality and they're quality advocates, you know, that, that must be really important for them.
Yeah. And you, you know, part of it is keeping the data and making it, possible to get it back. But also understanding how the how things flow through the system. We were talking before about the complexity of distributed systems, and even though we're not fully there at .0, we have a pretty complex system. And being able to trace the calls to our endpoints as they go through the different parts of the system, so we can dig deeper, is very important. So, for example, you know, when we run a load test, and if we do find a problem, we want to be able to dig deep and find out where that problem's coming from. That's kind of the point. And if you don't have that, the setup in, and this setup doesn't directly, like, it's not directly the purview of your load testing framework or anything. It's something rooted much deeper in your development, toolkit, in what kind of investment you're making in observability with traceability and monitoring, et cetera.
No, that's great. So it'd be great. I know you've got some fantastic tips on this, and you know I love the blog, so I'm going to recommend everybody who's listening today check out theqaleague.com and look for quality engineering remote teams, and you'll pick up Bernardo's great article. As far as kind of some kind of best ways to kind of get in touch with you, you know, reach out, you know, and also you know some you know the best way to get hold of you. What would that be?
So actually that's an interesting question in terms of the timing. I've been wrapping up some personal stuff, but once I'm done with that, one of the things that I plan to do is be a little bit more involved in the community. I'm on already in a couple of Slacks, like the one for PACT, the contract testing tool. But you can reach out to me on Twitter or Medium, at Bernardo Bridge. But one of the things that I actually really want to do, because it was an unfinished thing that I didn't get to do more of in my previous company, was some mentoring opportunities. And one of the things that I'm considering doing is taking some people who either want to get into testing or even software development as a whole, and it's kind of hard to start, or people who haven't maybe want to do more on the automation side of testing, and perhaps doing some you know some free mentoring sessions there, where I can point them in the right direction and, you know, give a few of the baselines, like some of the things like we discussed, like, you know, what's contract testing or what's, talking about a little bit about distributed systems or even the, you know, the whole software development lifecycle, those things that they're kind of like nowadays a little bit a prerequisite for being in tech. So yeah, if anyone wants to reach out to me, about that, I'd be happy to help out and we can do something.
Yeah, no, I think that'd be absolutely awesome. I know a lot of people may take you up on that. You know, I think the ability to find a mentor and, you know, is really important for people who are kind of starting on this career. And, you know, I'll also refer you on, we're doing as part of the BCS, so the British Computer Society, we're actually doing a mentoring system for testers for the specialist interest group. So, you know, I'll put your name forwards because I think you'd be absolutely fantastic, a perfect fit
Thank
for
you.
That.
Thank you.
So yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure today. And, you know, we'll have to get you back on the show in a couple of months once we're all out of lockdown and see how you've got on.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been a real pleasure too.